good morning and welcome. It is final draft time on 2SER 107.3. 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning is time for books, writing and literary culture. Today on the show, I have got some amazing conversations, some amazing ideas to ponder over, and I've got some old friends. First up, Jessica Hamilton. If you remember back to the days of going back about 5 years when I started on the show, Jess Hamilton also worked with me. She is joining me again today, and she's got a conversation with oft-times controversial cartoonist and duck fancier Michael Lunig. Michael has a new collection of cartoons out, Ducks for Dark Times. Jess is going to be talking to him about his work and philosophy, and also about some of the controversial work that he has put out recently. Later on in the show, I'm going to be joined by another old friend. Over the years, I have spoken to Solari Gentile many times about her Roland Sinclair mysteries. Number 8 in the series, A Dangerous Language, is out right now, and we're going to be finding out what is happening in 1930 Sydney, what trouble has Roland Sinclair gotten himself into, and also the parallels between the rise of fascism in the 1930s and our current political climate. I love being able to have these discussions, being able to have these debates and engaging in these ideas every week on Final Draft. I'm so glad you can join me. And those conversations are coming up on 2SER 107.3 just after this very short break.
What happens when make-believe believes it's real? In the House, cult film classics return to Event Cinemas George Street, November 10, with Pan's Labyrinth. Innocence has a power evil cannot imagine.
Con la tiza, trazaréis el contorno de una puerta en cualquier parte de vuestra habitación.
Hosted by Seven's Jabba and Jill from Kapow. Check the full In the House program and grab tickets at eventcinemas.com.au. Event Cinemas George Street, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and I'm Andrew Popel. Now, Michael Lunig is a political cartoonist and social commentator whose work has adorned many of the broadsheets. Perhaps you know him best from calendars stuck to your nan's fridge, but Michael was born in 1945 and began his life as a political cartoonist in 1969 in Melbourne. He's the creator of such whimsical characters as Mr. Curly and the Duck, and was declared a living treasure by the National Trust in 1999. Now, Lunig has also courted controversy in recent years with cartoons espousing an anti-vaccine perspective, as well as a fairly inscrutable look at the same-sex marriage debate that appeared in recent weeks. Now, Michael has a new collection out. It's called Ducks for Dark Times, featuring his signature style. And Final Draft producer and an old friend, she has been a part of this show for years, Jessica Hamilton, spoke with Lunig around the release, and they began their conversation exploring exactly who the ducks are and what are the dark times.
The duck clearly is an amiable, innocent, creaturely thing of nature. And I don't know a person who's got a problem with ducks. You know, they're kind of likeable. No one seems to have any argument. And they're kind of good-natured, it seems. Their beak is not pointy and striking and can dig a hole. It's rounded and gentle. Mm. And they dabble rather than pick. And they swim. And they can swim. They can fly. They can walk. They're pretty multi-talented, but they're not particularly good at any of those things. The dark times are always with us, and they sort of the nature of the darkness changes. I get the feeling, on my perspective, at my age, I sense we're in a very difficult and anxious time. And of course, we do our best to turn away from that and pretend it's not happening. And so my duck is sometimes a direction-finding duck, meaning, you know, when you're lost, when you don't know what to do, when you're sort of giving up, you're in despair, follow the duck. It will show you the way. Now, I'm not too earnest about that. You know, it's a little whimsical idea. Turn to nature, maybe. There's a path.
I love it. There's the one of the man going into his man cave, and I staggered into the duck pen, quacking and despairing, and so I came unstuck then, all happy and uncaring. You just think, oh, Where are my ducks? How do I find these ducks? I think that's something that appeals to a lot of people in your poetry or your cartoons, the aspect of whimsy and that longing to return or really connect to nature that may feel lost to people. Is there a balance between reconnecting with nature and reconnecting with love and nourishing that side of the self to a more outward responsibility to contribute to a wider society in that same respect? Like, where's the line between turning away, as you were saying before, and making sure that you're not sort of hibernating and totally disconnecting?
Right. Well, I'd say they're very connected. I think we have to go inwards in order to go outwards. We must first go inwards. Or, well, not first necessarily, but they are equally important. And you can't go outwards effectively and constructively and creatively unless you have done the inner work too. So they're very related. And as I say, this thing of love is being much misrepresented what it is. It's become a narrower and narrower definition in some ways. And whereas it requires a revival of what it truly means, and it means a commitment and work and trouble and all these things.
There's certainly a different kind of language that comes out in an online or social media space, which may not be the way that somebody would respond face to face in an actual human interaction. And then those words are kind of there permanently. And they may have vitriol or anger or you know, negativity behind them. Is there a role for anger and this kind of public combined energy of anger in society?
Well, anger, I mean, the Buddhists warn us against anger as being a non-productive thing, whereas the psychotherapists would say, look, anger is a healthy and natural thing to feel, and it would certainly appear to be. And then, you know, do we have our anger, or does our anger have us? And the other factor on social media, it becomes a kind of an angry critical mass. It seems to develop a life of its own, get lost. And you have to ask, what is this anger? Why are people so cranky? And why are they so brittle? And why are they so outraged that someone says a wrong thing? It's just a few words, but it's not. It's offensive, you see. And it's what in newspapers we would call predictable outrage. You can write a piece, and you know for sure that you are going to attract some really nasty reaction.
I guess I'm sort of wondering, like, what's your view of, what would you think of freedom of expression as a right, I guess, as a person and as an artist?
Well, it's a lovely idea. And I've been in trouble with my expression. I've been in court a number of occasions for obscenity, right? Because this is part of the 60s struggle against censorship of just natural, you know, human sexuality, which was so repressive, so Victorian. So I'd made cartoons about this and ended up in court and charged with obscenity. It's something that can't happen anymore, as far as I understand it. So this freedom of expression, which hurts people, accidentally I've hurt a lot of people, even in making references to religion in stuff that wasn't intentionally destructive but is interpreted as such. So regardless of your expression, you're going to hurt people because people are going to be hurt. They're hypersensitive and irrational in some ways, but that's the nature of life. So one has to be careful of being respectful to some degree, but to what a point, to what extent are you going to repress yourself? I mean, the artist's work is to express what is repressed. And there's a lot is repressed in our society. We're all repressed, more or less, somehow.
Are you conscious of who you're creating for when you make your artworks or poems or cartoons? Is it whether it's this audience that you're creating for or the publication or just for yourself?
Yeah, I think I am. It might be an illusion I have, an imagined human, but I think it is a more eternal sort of human. Like, I mean, the sort of points I am trying to illuminate or the themes I am illuminating are probably just eternal themes. They're there in the ancient texts, you know. They're biblical, they're Shakespearean, they're in Eastern poetry or whatever. There is nothing so new about these themes that I am addressing. I'm just, you know, my own idiosyncratic way, my little characters I draw. Yeah, sure, they're different, and they seem to be more flippant or sort of humorous. But essentially, it is about this kind of question of what is this life, and what is love, and what is sorrow, and what is grief, and what are we doing here, and what is worth doing, and what is worth having. And it's kind of, I'm not strident and recommending anything. I'm just deeply interested in the questions and the way people connect.
Are you conscious of the meaning that people are going to try to understand, whether it speaks to them subjectively, it's understood, misunderstood, or just not understood at all? Do you feel responsible to explain your artworks when they are, in your eyes, misunderstood or not understood?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Look, it's a question that's long been has been important for me for a long time. I'm aware of it, that people don't understand, and that doesn't bother me, because there is such a thing as a nourishing mystery that sometimes, I think of my own when I was younger, and I would come across something, maybe a poem or just some expressive bit of art, and say, what is that? So we can't expect to understand everything straight up front. In fact, some of the most delightful things in life and the profound things are acquired tastes. And that which is instantly gratifying is often, you know, fades away pretty quick too. So there's that factor operates. The fact is, I don't mind that. I'm not trying to tell anyone anything in my work. I'm not trying to suggest a particular thing. I'm trying to awaken someone. If you have your own sensibility and you express it, and actually it is reasonably well received, I think a lot of people find this a bit threatening, you know. And I have to be diminished.
One particular cartoon just in recent times of yours that has drawn criticism was the same-sex marriage, Yes, No, No, Yes, which the criticism was that you weren't necessarily clear about a particular power structure. And a lot of people were demanding that you kind of put a statement alongside that and explain your meaning or the significance behind that cartoon. For you, was that cartoon and the response to it expected, or...?
I didn't see any response to it, quite frankly. I sort of turn away and I expect, look, there's going to be outrage from some, and I'll interpret it this way and that way. I was really... Sometimes I have to be a voice for a silent majority, if you would like to put it that way, perhaps. I think there's a lot of people who are a bit worn and weary of this whole embittered kind of so-called debate. And I think a lot of people wanted that the politicians make a decision in the first place. And there's a kind of certain exhaustion, a fatigue comes about.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. You're on Final Draft, and I'm your host, Andrew Popel. That was Jessica Hamilton there speaking with Michael Lunig around the release of his latest collection, Ducks for Dark Times. Michael was reflecting there on who he perceives his audience to be and what he's speaking to, particularly in some of his controversial cartoons. Now, the nature of anything controversial is that there are going to be different views. We'd love for you to tweet us at FinalDraft2SER if you've got any ideas and thoughts on that interview. Right now, though, we're going to take a track. This is from Melbourne band RVG. They've got a new album out, and this is the title track, A Quality of Mercy.
guess what? It's pretty unfair. They're gonna give me the electric chair. I thought that someone would have changed their mind, but seems like got about an hour's time to be staring at the ceiling, feeling numb. I'm thinking about the readers at the Herald Sun who say that I am evil. They say hurry up, get on with it. Get what you get, what you get, what you get. Beth Miller from Malvern writes, this execution doesn't make things right. She'd rather see me drawn and quartered after about a Chinese. What a torture, she says. Everybody is so PC. If drugs make you suffer, then so should we. Well, if I have but one request out of our Beth to pull the switch, she should get what she gets, what she gets, what she wants to get. What a man who after the argument saw a little bit less of each other, then must have stumbled home, crying themselves a half dead. Guess what? Going to die. But you want first dibs at my corpse, so well, what makes you feel better? You can open me up, you can dig forever. You won't find what you're looking for. There's no evil in me. There's no evil in me. There was never any evil in me. There's no evil.
You're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and I'm Andrew Popel. And Solari Gentile needs no introduction for many Final Draft listeners. She's a prolific writer, and I am unabashedly a fan of her Roland Sinclair mysteries. Today, we are treated to the 8th installment, A Dangerous Language. Solari, welcome.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here again.
And it's a pleasure to be back with Roland Sinclair. He's an artist of exceptional, if controversial, talent. In 1930s Sydney, Roland has struggled to gain the ear of those in power to warn them of the looming threat emerging in Europe. This has been building and building over 7 books. We're now in our 8th. He's now ostracized from high society. Roland must maintain a semblance of social graces whilst working behind the political scenes. And in 1934, A Dangerous Language sees Roland volunteer himself as a pilot to smuggle famed journalist and writer Egon Kish against the will of the Australian government to speak out against the rise of fascism in Europe and its growing threat to the world. Now, this is the setup. Solari, can you elaborate a little bit on the historical milieu and the forces that Roland's finding himself caught between in A Dangerous Language?
Well, A Dangerous Language is set in late 1934, and it actually brings together a lot of the seeds that have been set in the earlier 1930s and in earlier books. So Egon Kish, this is not his first meeting with Roland Sinclair. He actually featured in Paving the New Road, and he was a wonderful figure in history, and he's one of those people, when you're reading historical texts and you come across them, they just sort of grab you because they're shining examples of humanity. Now, Egon Kish was a journalist, and he was one of the first people to be incarcerated by the Nazis 1933. He was eventually, because he was Czechoslovakian by birth, he was eventually deported back to Czechoslovakia, and he spent the rest of his life basically going around, and certainly until after the war was over, trying to educate the world on the dangers that the Nazis posed to world peace and to humanity in general. He was invited to Australia in 1934 by a group called the Movement Against War and Fascism, and he was to speak as a peace advocate. Now, what Rowley's facing at the time is the resistance of the rest of the world to actually confront Nazism and what was happening in Germany. And so when Egon Kish attempted to come to Australia, the Lyons government actually tried their level best to keep him out. The Attorney General at the time had been newly appointed. It was Robert Menzies. And he made it his mission to make sure that Egon Kish did not set foot in Australia. And to that end, they used the Immigration Restriction Act, which we know more colloquially as the White Australia Policy. But the feeling at the time was very similar, I think, in some ways, to the feeling now, where we have this troubling rise of political dissent and political movements in the world, where people have very strong feelings one way or another, where there is this increase in nationalism, where people who seem to invade our sense of what our borders are and what our nationhood is are reviled. And yet there are also people who are fighting very hard in the other direction as well.
Yeah, and as we begin this novel, Roland is with his two particular friends, Milton and Clyde. Edna has yet to join them. But Roland is still, I guess, very much suffering personally from the setback of the, I guess I would say, relatively failure of his art show, where he had tried to educate his peers about this rising threat of fascism. And I found the group normally such a rich source of fun and joy, and I always love their repartee. I felt like in A Dangerous Language, as the stakes rise, the tone became darker. Roland's particularly, he's increasingly estranged from his brother. And this task of warning the world about what he has seen in Germany is weighing really heavily on him. Was there a conscious shift in mood for you in writing the book?
It's a funny thing, Andrew. I think what's happened, and I've often asked this question of myself, I don't know that it's conscious. I think it's a reaction to the change in the way I look at things. So when I first started writing this series with a few right-thinking men, I was incredibly optimistic about human beings and about Australia's place in how these machinations and how these movements worked. I remember writing in the afterword of a few right-thinking men that Australia was one of the few places in the world where, you know, tens of thousands of men could gather with arms ready for revolution and in the end just go home. And I love that about Australia. And I did really sincerely believe that there was something special about this country, that we were impervious to the kind of movements and the kind of passions and prejudices that seem to beset the rest of the world. As this, as the last 10 years have unfolded, I've been less sure of that. And I presume that that's reflected in Roland as well. So as much as I have an influence on how he thinks, I think what he's experiencing in the 1930s has an influence on me.
Now, we talked a little bit off air about how Roland's stories have certain historical destinations. As much as we can see him as the crime fiction hero, we know he's not going to prevent the beginning of the Second World War. But A Dangerous Language shows us this interesting world that feels identifiable. We see groups of openly hostile fascists resorting to violence to further their conservative ends. There's a growing movement of anti-fascism stirring itself to prevent them. world history right now is working to provide you with an extremely receptive audience to this.
It is. World history is, you know, I sometimes feel like I tempted fate, because, you know, with that very first book where I was, you know, thinking that this could never happen again, that the 1930s could never happen again, and certainly Australia was impervious to it. History is showing me that it's not the case.
Mm.
Not so much history, but contemporary politics is showing me that it's not the case. And it, in some ways, it has been useful for the series, because my disillusionment has sort of followed the same lines as Roland's. And, you know, you can call it disillusionment, you can call it maturing, you can call it losing your naivety. But there is certainly much material in today's politics that is running so closely parallel to what happened in the 1930s. I was just editing Gentlemen Formerly Dressed, which is the fifth book in the series. So because my books are now available are being released in America, I take the opportunity to glance through the manuscript one more time while I can fiddle with it or tweak it or correct the odd spelling mistake that's made its way through. And so I hadn't actually read the book since it had been written in 2012, I think it was. And there was a paragraph in there where William Joyce, who became Lord Haw-Haw, who was a very famous member of the British fascists, was talking about making Britain great again.
Mm.
And I thought, my God, the echoes are so loud that it's, you know, it's really quite startling even to me. And this was written long before we saw the change in American politics that we have seen in the last few years.
Back when reality stars were just reality stars.
Exactly, exactly. And so it's really quite startling. And when you actually have looked at what happened with the Nazi Party and how they actually came into power, and the propaganda that they employed and the tactics they employed and the kind of rhetoric they employed, and you hear it again in this day and age, it's really quite a startling and a tragic and a frightening thing. Look, the wonderful thing about that particular period of history and in the lead up to the war is that there is a lot of material. There's a lot of things that I have yet to explore, that Roland has yet to explore and has yet to experience. I fully intend to write him right through World War II. I can tell you now that the last book will be in 1945. What it will be about, I have no idea, but it was always my intention from the very first book to take this young man right through the 30s and see what the war does to him.
There you are, two SER listeners. You heard it here. Roland is going through to 1945. We have got some adventures to go on yet. Solari Gentile is the author of the Roland Sinclair Mysteries. A Dangerous Language is the latest installment. It's got a beautiful cover. You cannot miss it in your bookstore. Solari, thank you so much for coming and chatting with us again.
Always a pleasure, Andrew.
Our 2017 supporter drive is over.
A huge thank you to everyone that supported again this year, and a welcome to all our new supporters.
Your money will go towards 2SER making real radio for another year.
So thank you, thank you, thank you.
2SER 107.3, stories, ideas, music.
Yes, this is 2SER 107.3, and you are tuned in to Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel. I am the host of Final Draft. And on behalf of me and everyone involved in Final Draft, also, thank you. Thank you so much. All the support that came through for Supporter Drive is what allows us to stay on air and make this fantastic radio that we bring you every week. I really appreciate it. I love the opportunity to be sharing these books, and it's so important. Now, I'm almost out of time. Do stay tuned for The Vulture's Nest. I want to send a big thank you to Jessica Hamilton, Final Draft producer Jessica Hamilton, Michael Lunig, who spoke with Jessica, also to Solari Gentile, who shared her latest Roland Sinclair mystery. Look, I am back next week with more books, writing, and literary culture, as I do every week. And if you are looking for more books, why not tune in Tuesday Tuesdays to Brekkie, where Nick Healy and I discuss more fantastic literature in the Tuesday Book Club. But until next week, I am Andrew Popel. This has been Final Draft, and I'll see you later.